Yes, after nearly 2 years of a campaign where Americans could hardly fail to learn everything there is to know about their candidates, the undecided voice weighs in.
In no way I'm voting for a Muslim. The other guy is too old.
Run that by me again.
In no way I'm voting for a Muslim. The other guy is too old. In no way I'm voting for a Muslim. The other guy is too old. In no way I'm voting for a Muslim. The other guy is too old.
Oh, that's the voice of a real voter in Missouri, the show-me state. 5 weeks to go, and it's the Muslim versus the old guy? Is that undecided or ADD? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 2nd.
Now, good morning. Keep moving. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, John. Today, the financial plan to steady the U.S. markets is in the hands of the House of Representatives. That's because late last night, the Senate passed the revised measure with a bipartisan majority. Also, a view from the ground on the credit freeze. Car sales plummeted last month. And the vice presidential debate tonight, millions will be watching. We have a preview on a day where polls are showing the Obama ticket has an edge. Those stories coming up, but first a few headlines.
Last night, the Bush administration's financial rescue plan passed the Senate. After the vote, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said it benefits all Americans.
This is not a bailout for Wall Street. It's a bailout for our country.
The bill allows the government to spend billions of dollars to buy up bad debt. It now heads to the House for a vote as early as Friday. On news of the Senate vote, Asian markets closed down. The Nikkei lost 2%. The Hang Seng slipped more than 1%. European markets are responding more favorably. Also, European interest rates stayed the same today. Dow futures are down slightly this morning.
Warren Buffett sees a buying opportunity in all the market turmoil. He's investing $3 billion in General Electric. The top American commander in Afghanistan, General David McKiernan, says that it's an urgent need for troops and weapons there.
I think we are in a tough fight. So the idea that it might get worse before it gets better is certainly a possibility.
About 33,000 U.S. troops are there now. Violence in Afghanistan is up about 30% compared with last year.
Nuclear arms pact between India and the U.S. passed its final legislative hurdle yesterday. The Senate voted to let U.S. companies sell nuclear technology and fuel to India. U.N. officials say they've raised the security level for Pakistan's capital after a truck bombing at the Islamabad Marriott. It means international staff will no longer be allowed to live with their children in the capital. Lots of baseball last night. Dodgers beat the Cubs 7-2. Phillies beat the Brewers 3-1. In the American League, the Red Sox creamed the Angels 4-1. The Rays and the White Sox face off today.
And tonight is the first and only debate between vice presidential candidates Joe Biden and Sarah Palin. Oil's at $98 a barrel in Asian trading. The Dow closed slightly down yesterday at 10,831. The S&P was also slightly in negative territory. It's set to open at 1161.
Lots to talk about. We're talking about whether voters and people in the economy act fundamentally irrationally. If you've ever acted irrationally and been rewarded, tell us your story. If you've been punished, tell us your story. And the debate tonight, Palin versus Biden, what do you think? Do you have a question you'd like to ask? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, members of the House will have to take on what the Senate has done. Last night, they voted on a $700 billion plan to help resuscitate the economy. It was a bipartisan vote of 74 to 25. Let's turn now to Todd Zwillick, a reporter for Capital News Connection, for the latest. Todd, what's in the bill that passed?
Well, the old, familiar by now, bailout, well, we're not calling it bailout anymore, rescue plan is in there. A couple of sweeteners. You had the expansion of FDIC insurance from 100,000 to $250,000. And then this package of what are called extenders, and extenders is just another name for a big package of tax breaks that go to business, research and development tax credits, tax credits for renewable fuels, and the annual ritual of the patch for the alternative minimum tax. That was a tax that was a long time ago meant to hit just a couple of wealthy people and wound up bleeding into the middle class. So every year they patch it so that middle class folks don't have to pay it.
Let's talk about the politics first. Clearly, some significance must exist given the fact that it was a bipartisan vote.
Yes. Well, and that was sort of the point. This financial rescue bailout bill, it was actually never a question in the Senate. It's usually the opposite. Usually the House can pass things in lockstep with party loyalty, and then the Senate has all kinds of problems, 60-vote threshold, maverick senators running back and forth. The interesting thing was that this was exactly the opposite. This bill never had an issue in the Senate. It was always going to pass, and the House was always the issue. So the interesting thing was this week, after the bill failed in the House, you saw the Senate kind of say, all right, you've had your chance. We're taking over. We've got a broad bipartisan coalition for this bill. We're going to pass it. We're going to put the pressure on you guys. They've basically backed the House into a corner now. The session is over. Everybody says this is must pass. This is called jamming the House. This is the last choice, guys. It's this or nothing. Even though a lot of House members, Democrats especially, don't like some of these extenders, you'll vote for this or you'll get nothing. That's pretty much what's at stake here.
And included in that vote, both presidential candidates, Republican John McCain and Democrat Barack Obama, both voted for it.
Yeah, they did. And it was quite a scene on Capitol Hill yesterday evening, because not only did you have this huge vote that basically the entire universe was watching, and it's the end of the session, so it was really crowded around there. But then add in both nominees floating in and out of the building and hovering around, complete with Secret Service and their travel pools that travel with their campaigns all the time. Should mention that Joe Biden was in the building. People noticed that too. So, they both voted for it, probably gave it an extra push.
And, Todd, there is some irony here, which is there was much concern about putting so much of taxpayers' money at risk. Let's listen to how Senator Shelby describes what passed.
We're about to more than double the exposure of the already depleted deposit insurance fund, and by extension, the American taxpayer on a whim.
All the sweeteners that you talked about, how much are they going to add to this bill?
This is part of the controversy between the House and the Senate on these sweeteners, because there is an age-old confrontation between the House and the Senate about paying for these tax extenders and paying for patching the AMT. The long and the short of it is the House has insisted that those extenders and the AMT patch be paid for, i.e. you find revenue somewhere else or make cuts somewhere else. The Senate has said, we don't care about paying for it. Well, now the Senate is sending those back to the House, not paid for or only partially paid for in some cases, and saying to the House, especially House Democrats, last chance, guys. Enjoy voting for a lot of this stuff you oppose, because last chance.
So how do you foresee this discussion moving forward today, given the dynamics that you've just laid out?
Well, I had one. There were not a lot of House members around yesterday because it was still the recess from the Rosh Hashanah holiday. But there were a couple of them floating around, and the few that I ran into, well, not all of them, but a few of them happened to be Democrats, extremely unhappy, and basically said right now the dynamic is a lot of arm twisting and arm snapping and cajoling going on from the leaderships. Now, again, this is Democratic and Republican leaderships both favoring this bill, wanting it to pass. Republican leaders have told the Senate, Democratic leaders, when they decided for the Senate to go first on this, that they could deliver enough votes to push this over the line, because Democrats have to maybe count on losing, perhaps, it's hard to tell, maybe losing a couple votes over this pay-for issue on these extenders. So Republican leaders have promised that they can deliver quite more than the amount of votes they need to push it over the line. A lot of phone calls, a lot of personal meetings, a lot of group meetings, a lot of convincing, and a lot of head counting today. A lot of head counting going on today.
And probably a whole lot of drama, too. Todd Zwillick, thank you.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, our friend from Capital News Connection. He was reporting from Washington, D.C. John?
So lawmakers wandering around from the House and Senate, saving the world, they claim, but miserable about it. Yes, we would call predictable irrationality. Listen to Barack Obama talking about his motivations for voting for the package last night.
There will be time to punish those who set this fire, but now's not the time to argue about how it got set, or did the neighbor sleep in his bed or leave the stove on. Right now we want to put out that fire.
Well, what do you want, a fireman, or do you want revenge? Is it irrational for the House not to pass the bailout bill? We're talking about irrationality and when you've been punished or rewarded for it. Have you bought a house on a whim, asked someone to marry you, quit your job? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Well, all this contradictory feeling and irrationality is a job for Dan Ariely, who's a Duke University professor of behavioral economics and former member of the MIT Media Lab. First of all, Dan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Which do you want in a situation like this? Do you want revenge more, or do you want a fireman more?
Well, the question is, me as what? Me as a human being or me as a scientist? And it turns out that those things are different. But let me tell you a little bit about what we know about revenge. And the story is actually quite interesting. There's a game that behavioral economists and economists play with our participants in experiments, and it's called the trust game. So imagine, John, I gave you $10 and I had $10.
Right.
And I said, June, you have a choice. You can end the game now, both of us will go home, or you can pass me the $10. If you pass me the $10, it would somehow magically quadruple on the way. So if you send it to me, I will have $50, my original 10 plus your 10 that became 40.
Right.
I can do one of two things. I can split the money and give you $25 and keep $25, or I can take the $50 and go home. The first surprising observation is that unlike what the economic standard model would predict, that people would be selfish and say that the other person will never give them the money, so they should never trust them, people are actually surprisingly trusting. Hmm. They pass the $10, and surprisingly people split the pie and give $25 back. However, this game becomes more interesting when you add an opportunity for revenge. Imagine that I decided not to pass you back the $25. I keep all the $50 and I go home. And now you have a chance to punish me. But this is a punishment that would cost you money. For every dollar you invest, some entity will take $2 from me. You invest $3, I would lose $6. You invest $7, I would lose $14. Would you take revenge against me?
Even though it would cost me money. Even if it would cost me money. All right, let me think about that. Go ahead.
Turns out a lot of people take revenge. And what's more interesting is when you image their brain, when you look at what kind of brain activity they have, when they decide about revenge, it looks like they have activation in their brain in the same place that process pleasure, the same place that gets activated when we take heroin and have sex and eat food.
So the polling on this bailout plan, when Americans are calling up Congress and saying, don't vote for it, they're willing to pay tax money to punish bankers on Wall Street who they believe they need to exact some revenge from.
That's right. And I think the parallel is very appropriate here, that the bankers in Wall Street have in some sense walked away with our $50. I mean, it's actually been more than $50, right? But they've in some deep sense, people feel, have betrayed the public trust. And now people are willing to lose money.
I said it's a definition of taxpayer, people willing to lose money. Dan Ariely, we'll take a break and come back to you. I want to ask you how we got into this mix when we talked to you. Dan Ariely, Predictably Irrational is the title of his book, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. We're hearing from listeners with their take on the economic crisis.
Hi, my name's Regina. I'm a bus driver. I also work as a nail tech on weekends. And I really think it's time for a financial revolution. I'm just not getting easier. So I don't know exactly what the answer is, but I know we really need a big shakeup.
You can feel her holding the pitchfork there. That's right. 877-8-MY-TAKE with your view, irrational or not.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We're continuing our discussion with Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. Predictable irrationality, like in politics, you mean?
Hey, Rick from White Plains, New York. I did vote irrationally. In 1992, I voted for Bill Clinton because I was poor and I had no health insurance. Instead, he spent his entire administration attempting to get gay people into the military where they already were and to take away the guns that I owned. And that really taught me a hard lesson in voting irrationally.
That's Rick from White Plains. We touched his nerve. Dan Ariely, a behavioral economist at Duke University, touches nerves for a living. We're talking about irrationality on the program. Dan, thanks for coming back with us.
Sure.
We were talking before about the irrationality and the dilemmas that senators face voting for this bailout bill. But I wanted to talk with you about the irrationality in the broader economic system that got us to this point. What sort of irrational elements in the economic system motivate, say, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of bad loans to be put on the books of banks like Citigroup and Merrill Lynch?
Yeah, so there's a lot of reasons for this irrational behavior. You know, there's one way to be rational. There are many ways to be irrational. Let me give you a couple of examples.
Great.
A few years ago, I also, until recently, had a position in the Federal Reserve Bank, and my job there was to try to argue with the local rational economist about different ideas. And we were asked to write a paper about interest-only mortgages. So here's the story. If you're going to buy a house for $400,000 and you took a regular mortgage, your payment might be $2,800 a month.
Right.
If you got it with interest only, you would pay maybe only $1,500 a month, but at the end of the 10 years, you will owe $400,000. For the standard rational economist, this was a good deal. Why? Because it means that people have more flexibility. You pay less, and the extra $1,300 you have, you can choose to put toward the principal, pay health care, even pay your credit card bill. And in fact, one of my friends in the bank went ahead and found some data showing that people who had bigger credit card debts were more likely to take interest-only mortgages. So he said,
"Hey,
great."
People who were more in debt?
Yes. And he basically interpreted it as people being smart. He said, look, these are smart people. They got bad debt with credit card. They're going to take a cheaper loan, interest only, and they're going to pay off the credit card bills.
Yeah, well, did they?
Now, no. But I did a different study, and I basically tried to look at how people actually decide how much they can borrow. So let me ask you, if you went to buy a house tomorrow, how would you figure out how much house you should buy?
Oh. Quickly, I just write zero, you know, because I'm so strapped. But you know, I mean, I bought a couple of houses, and that calculation was strange and scary each time.
That's right. And actually, what people mostly do is they go on the web, and they go to one of these mortgage calculators,
right,
and they figure out how much they can borrow. Mind you, it's not how much you should borrow; it's how much you can borrow. It's how much the bank will give you.
That's exactly what we did. Yeah.
So now imagine that now when I come to the bank and I get interest-only mortgage, I'm not restricted to $400,000. I can borrow $550,000. Well, if I borrow more all of a sudden, I get not extra flexibility. And that's actually what people did. They basically just stretched the borrowing, increased their exposure in the market. So that was one thing we did very badly. We basically gave people too much flexibility, including the flexibility to fail. But here's another interesting story. There's something we call hyperbolic discounting. It's the fact that it's very hard to resist temptation in the near future and very easy to resist temptation in the long term. I'll give you a simple example. Have you ever gone to lunch thinking that you'll watch your weight and then the waiters come with a dessert tray, you smell the chocolate souffle and you succumb to temptation?
Of course.
Yeah, that has happened before.
That's an easy question, Dan. Mm-hmm.
That's an easy question. Well, it turns out some bankers came up with a loan that looks very much like chocolate souffle. It offered people 2 years of very cheap loans followed by 28 years of very expensive loan.
That's like
In fact, I just recently met somebody who's now stuck with the 28 years of paying 12% interest.
Oh my.
But because he had such a low interest rate in the beginning 2 years, he basically took this terrible, terrible loan. So that's a second I guess a second story.
I guess the question is, you know, not only for the borrowers, but for the banks. What is rational about the banks doing this?
So there's a few things. One is that people, I think, assume a lot of wisdom on the part of the market. As a function of that, they do all kinds of crazy things as long as people are willing to buy it. There's a new book that came out recently called Billion Dollar Mistakes. And in this book, they describe a story about people who decided to give mortgages for mobile homes. Mortgages for mobile homes used to last only 10 or 15 years, and this company decided to extend it to 30 years. Well, it was more appealing to people. The payment every month were lower, and many, many people got these mortgages for 30-year loans on mobile homes. Well, mobile home turns out not to last very long. In fact, they don't last much beyond 10 or 15 years.
So banks were giving loans for houses that last a third of the length of the loan.
That's right.
That's crazy.
Now, somebody else was willing to buy the loan from them. So there was a whole incentive to sell this crazy loan because nobody was really looking. Nobody was really paying attention to what these loans are. People assumed, oh, other people are buying it. It must be a great thing. As a consequence, the company increased in value about 40 times. Luckily, they sold off way before the loans came to expire.
A giant financial game of musical chairs. Hold on right there, Dan. We're going to get some headlines. Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions, and also Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics. And now, headlines from Richard Hake.
28 minutes past the hour, John. A small to moderate earthquake has shaken San Bernardino County in California, but there are no immediate reports of injury or damage. The magnitude 4.1. tremor struck. It was centered about 70 miles east of Los Angeles. U.S. nuclear envoy Chris Hill is extending his stay in North Korea to hold more talks today. North Korea caused alarm earlier this year by moving to restart its military facilities. Somalia has authorized foreign powers to use force against pirates holding a Ukrainian ship carrying 33 tanks. Though a number of U.S. Navy ships surround the boat, there has been no indication they will take any action. Meanwhile, the EU will establish a security force to tackle the increasing number of pirates off the coast of Somalia. The French government says at least 8 countries have agreed to participate. And finally, iTunes is facing off with big record labels. The National Music Publishers Association has requested a 66% price increase in its digital music sales, a hike that Apple has flatly refused to pay or pass on to customers. The Copyright Royalty Board in Washington is expected to rule on the matter later today.
So it's gone to arbitration.
And if the request is granted, then either Apple or the record industry must eat that cost.
So no more 99-cent songs if they rule against.
Probably not. I mean, I couldn't see Apple not handing it off to the customers.
Well, yeah, I think we should go down to Washington
maybe fewer,
and protest.
Fewer songs on
iTunes.
What's
more important? That's one story to watch for sure.
99-second songs or the Palin-Biden debate, which is more important?
I think the song. People are probably going to affect them more with the song.
Thank you, Richard. The debate. I'm on the side of the debate.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Yeah, I'll be voting. It's just hard to decide which idiot to vote for.
Can you see yourself voting for Senator Obama?
I can't see myself really voting for either one. That's why I can't make up my mind. I don't like either one of them. I don't trust them.
That's some deep indecision in Missouri that seems to have been something, or it is something, that is shared by many voters just 5 weeks away from the presidential election. Joining us now for another chapter in our Counties That Count series is Takeaway Political Director Andrea Bernstein. She's in Franklin County, Missouri, which voted twice for President Bush and before that twice for President Clinton. So they have a knack there, Andrea, for picking the winner.
Yes, I do. In fact, in Missouri, in the past 100 years, only in one election has the state of Missouri not picked the presidential winner. I'm right now at Cowan's Restaurant, which is just off of Main Street in Washington, Missouri, not, as they say here, the other Washington. And it's a very, very interesting crowd here this morning. I've been here for about an hour. Lots of construction workers coming in and out. Lots of white men, which is McCain's most natural constituency. And I'm hearing in this area, which is a very risk-averse area, I mean, one indication is the foreclosures are half the national average. One businessman told me here that's because they don't get into these fancy debt schemes here. They're very sort of essentially conservative. But here in the restaurant, I heard a lot of banter back and forth about tonight's debate. And I heard one gentleman say to another one, well, it's not who I'm voting for, it's who I'm voting against. And I said, well, who's that?
That's interesting. He
said, so who do you think he's voting against? He's voting against John McCain. And his breakfast companion said, well, I don't know who I'm voting for, but it won't be the Republicans. So that is a sense of the mood here. A pretty big shift from when I was here last, before the convention. And you can hear that with a gentleman I spoke to last night, an electrician, and his sense of the economic bailout.
Well, I don't know. I'm not a finance wizard. I'm just a poor working stiff. And, you know, I just know how I got to manage my money to survive. And I know I can't keep living on borrowed money. You know, I got to pay my bills. I think it's time that that America does the same thing.
So as the debate continues in Washington on what to do about the financial crisis, you have all of these voters trying to make up their minds. Do you think that this vice presidential debate tonight is going to help them do that, make up their minds?
Everybody here told me that they were going to be watching the debate. They were going to be watching really closely what Sarah Palin said. Of course, many of them saw her convention speech, and they've seen some of the interviews. But there's still a sense, voters kept saying, I don't know who she is. I don't know where she stands. I want to know more about what she has to say on the economy. I think that Sarah Palin has the potential to roil the race by stopping what's been a pretty bad week for John McCain, a pretty bad month of October, even though it's only 2 days in, or by not making that happen. And a lot of power is in her hands. A lot of people really watching carefully tonight's debate. So many people here are waiting to have the deal closed. Everybody, especially women, say, I'm undecided. I haven't chosen my candidate yet. But when I spoke to women like this woman, Susan, a secretary out in front of a Droege supermarket on Main Street yesterday, she said to me, well, I'm undecided, but listen to what happened when I sort of pushed her hard and said, well, where do you think you're going to go with that?
What do you think about President Bush?
I'm very disappointed, especially the last 2 years. Very disappointing.
Now, when people say, oh, well, McCain would be more of that, well, what do you say to that?
I used to think that he wouldn't be, but as the closer we get to the election, the more I think they're right. He is more of the same. In a lot of ways, I know there are, you know, he has his differences, but it's disappointing because I really like him.
Can you see yourself supporting Senator Obama?
Yeah, I could. I think it's going to depend a lot in the next. I'm really interested in this debate, and I want to listen to that.
It's such an interesting piece of sound in that interview you did, Andrea, because essentially that comment the woman you were interviewing made parallels what the latest polls show, which show that Bush has a very, very low approval rating and that Obama has gotten a bit of a bump in the last week or two.
Right. And when I was here last summer, I mean, this is a very, you know, an area where a lot of people came out and voted in the Republican primary, even if after it was already settled. A lot of people voting for Mike Huckabee, a big pro-life contingent here in Franklin County, and a lot of goodwill towards Republicans. And what you're hearing is a sense of they're sort of being pushed out of it. I heard a lot around the time of the convention of John McCain's a maverick. He's not just another George Bush. I'm hearing less and less. In fact, I'm hearing a conversation like the one I heard with the Dell couple last night out on Main Street. They disagree, but this is the kind of conversation that's going on in kitchen tables around America.
Anyway, I was far from McCain, and now I'm kind of leaning toward Obama.
I think I just like more of what he stands for.
You mean in terms of his policies?
Yes. The changes that will be made.
Do you agree with her?
No.
You're voting McCain?
Yes.
What is it you like about him?
Well, I just like his experience, his age. He does have a handle on the economy, and he's not, as everyone said, with the president 99% of the time. He's a maverick.
Yeah. And I was impressed with the first debate.
Yeah.
Between McCain and Obama. And I was extremely impressed with Obama, and I think that's when I shifted.
Andrew, I'm going to bring in Dan Ariely, who's the author of Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. And he's also a Duke professor of behavioral economics. And Dan, what do you make of all of this skepticism?
Well, we had a lot of hard time in the past few years. And the mistrust of people in the political system, I think, has been eroding dramatically. So I think this skepticism is only to be expected.
So hard times encourage people not to make a decision. They pull them back from making a decision, it sounds like what you're saying.
That's right. One of the things we find is that when you face more difficult, emotion, complex decision, people basically hold back. They procrastinate, they delay, they don't make a decision. But at the end, if they're forced to make a decision, often what they do is they go to the default. They go to whatever was the natural, original option for them.
Huh. Andrea, are you hearing that?
Yeah.
Yes. I think that that is what is happening here. And I think one of the risks for Obama is there is, after all, still a long time till the election. And what's gone in Washington this week has really soured people on the political process. So even though the polls are trending in his direction, Obama has that to deal with in the next 5.5 weeks.
Andrea Bernstein, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway's political director in our series on counties that count. She's in Missouri and finding lots of indecision there.
We have counties that count map on the vote2008thetakeaway.org. You can go there and find out if you live in a county that counts. Lots of interesting information. Guess what? I don't live in a county that counts.
Me neither, sadly.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And in some places, drivers are getting some relief at the gas pump with prices down to $3.62. At least that's a national average. But not in Georgia. Following hurricanes Ike and Gustav, 15 refineries along the Gulf Coast were shut down. Now suppliers are coming through more regularly for the first time in a month, but there's some lingering pain. Harriet Lay is on the line from Athens, Georgia. She's been in the business 20 years, and today she co-owns and operates Lay Brothers Shell Gas Station. Good morning, Harriet, and how's business?
Good morning. It's interesting at this point in time, but may I make a small correction? I actually was raised in the business, and so I've been there long time, and we don't do service stations. We're a wholesaler. We're the jobber. We're the ones that haul the product to the service stations.
So describe the problem you're facing at the moment.
There's just no product. In fact, I've got a truck sitting over at a terminal right now searching for gas for one of my commercial customers. It's just very difficult. The panic buying that set in emptied the reserves, and it's just a matter of logistics. The pipeline's flowing, but it's got to go through so many states before it gets here.
So explain that. How much reserve did you have before the hurricanes, and what are you looking at now or have been looking at?
Well, what we're looking at right now is just a severe shortage that the pipeline has not reestablished and reserves have not been built back up. That's what we're looking at right now. They keep telling us every week, they say, it's going to get better, and you just have to keep on hoping that it does get better.
So who's more frustrated, customers or suppliers, in these discussions that you have with people every week and every day?
Well, most of my customers are farmers, commercial accounts, and that sort of thing. And they've been very understanding and very patient. They know we're doing the best we can to get them product. other distributors, we're all trying to work together. If I can get it and they can't, or they can get it and I can't, we try to help one another out when we can. But it has not been as bad as where I am as it has been in Atlanta.
Right.
Atlanta is about 75 miles southwest of me. We're in northeast Georgia. We have not experienced the long lines here that they have, but of course we don't have the population that they have either.
Are you encouraged at all that their flows of gas seems to be picking up a bit?
Yeah, it's a help, and it's just not gasoline. It's also diesel fuel. And you see, we're primarily in a farming community down here where I am, and hay's on the ground, and the farmers can't get tractor fuel to roll the hay.
Harriet Lay, thank you for joining us. She's a co-owner and operator of Lay Brothers Shell Oil in Athens, Georgia, and it certainly sounds very frustrating. You can hear that in her voice.
Well, you know, it's interesting how the psychology is what's going on there, because it's not so much the storm that caused the problem. It's the panic buying that depleted the resources, and that's what she's dealing with right now. It's really interesting.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 2nd. It is Vice Presidential Debate Day, and there are some other headlines today also, and Richard Hake has those. He's sitting in for Femi Okeh. Richard.
And Adora, jobless claims remain at a seven-year high due to the weak economy and the impact of hurricanes, those figures just released. A U.S. soldier has pleaded guilty to charges of accessory to murder in the killings of four Iraqi prisoners. U.S. Army Specialist Stephen Robordi faces up to 5 years in prison and must testify in the prosecution against others alleged to have taken part in those killings. At least four people are dead after a suicide attack near a politician's home in northwest Pakistan. The politician was unhurt, but at least four people were killed in today's blast. Also, federal prosecutors are planning to play audio tapes for a jury they say will show Senator Ted Stevens knew he was wrong when he failed to report over $250,000 in gifts from an oil pipeline firm. Those are some of the top stories this morning.
Thank you. Very sad economic news there, which is affecting the markets, by the way. The Dow futures are down now 136 points, so that will be a negative open. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
So we're talking about psychology from many perspectives this morning. We're deep inside the brain. Dan Ariely, Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics, touches nerves for a living. And, of course, he did it again this morning.
Your guest, Dan Ariely, is missing the point. He's implying that all revenge is irrational. What about the criminal justice system? That's a form of revenge. The idea is deterrence. And in this case of the economy, the idea is like a fine to prevent future Wall Streeters from doing the same stupid thing.
Dan Ariely, you can feel the revenge there. What do you make of that?
So first of all, it's a question of what's the definition of irrationality and irrationality. Let's think about revenge for a second. The question that I think the listener was bringing up is whether revenge makes sense. And I think you can see how it would make sense. So imagine you and I lived a few thousand years ago without police and without law enforcement and law, and you one day stole my donkey. Now, let's say you stole my donkey and you went far away. If I was just doing the cost-benefit analysis, I would say, you know what, John is at least a day away. It's not worth my time to chase him for 2 days to get a donkey. Forget about it. But if I have revenge, and then I will chase you to the end of the world, and I will not only take my donkey, I will take two of yours and, you know, your neighbors and so on.
And all the women and
now,
children.
Now, if you know that, you will basically not take my donkey. So revenge, you can think about it as a sensible thing in a system that has no law, because all of a sudden it can restore cooperation between people. So from that perspective, the listener is very correct that revenge can be a very useful thing.
But in a larger
world,
when you act... Oh, go ahead, Dan, quickly.
However, if we have a legal system, and now you're saying that you're willing to lose $14 for me to lose 28, and it doesn't really impact the legal system or the long-term effect of behavior, then it's not that as useful anymore.
Then it's not really affecting the system. It's more just giving you a personal sense of revenge, which doesn't really, in any assured way, deter anything. As the system gets more complex, the sense of unpredictability as a consequence of personal actions becomes much, much greater. I want to bring into the conversation Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who's the author of The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable. He's a distinguished professor of risk engineering at New York University's Polytechnic Institute and a visiting professor of marketing at the London Business School. He's on the line with us from upstate New York. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, thanks for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
You describe black swan events as highly unpredictable events, but in a system where you ought to be able to expect the improbable as a matter of course. In the case of the financial meltdown, it seems as though risk management didn't really foresee the unpredictable. How does that work?
Yeah, well, I was a trader for 20 years, and for 20 years I've been fighting over the scientific arrogance. Everything, the risk management systems were built on pseudoscience. The techniques don't work. We knew that. Most traders knew that. Yet they were used as an excuse by people to take huge amounts of hidden risks. And they did that for a very long time. In my story of the Black Swan, I talk about surprises, and you have the story of the turkey. A turkey is fed for 1,000 days. On the 1,001st day, it's Thanksgiving minus two, the turkey's not fed. It's got to be a surprise. But it would be a black swan that is a surprise for the turkey. It would not be for the butcher. Okay.
Right.
So to me, what happened here was not a black swan. Okay. I wrote the book of Black Swan. And I'm saying, listen, it's going to be a black swan for the bankers. It's going to be a black swan for those risk pseudo experts. It's going to be a black swan for the taxpayer. But it's not a black swan for anyone who knows anything about these risk systems. They don't work. It's sort of like getting on a plane and seeing a pilot who's totally incompetent. You know the plane is going to crash. So it is so predictable. That was very predictable. A lot of people, including myself, have been warning people to no avail for a long time.
Well, why do you think there's so much resistance to that notion if you know in the end you're going to lose even if you gain in the short term?
Let me tell you why. Because there's a notion of moral hazard. They don't want to understand the point for the following reason. If you're a banker, you get bonuses every year. And look what happened. You get bonuses. Stanley O'Neill of Merrill Lynch got $160 million out of this. Now we're footing the bill, and he keeps his $160 million. So you have a symmetric payoff. The bankers make all the money, and when they lose the money, we pay for it. So it is exactly the opposite of socialism. People think it's socialism. People were telling me, oh, this looks like France. The banks are nationalized. No, the banks are not. It's the opposite. The banks took over the government.
Right.
Okay? So, because we are nationalizing, we're privatizing the profits, where these people kept their profits, and we are nationalizing the losses.
Dan Ariely, what is the difference in Europe for you from the improbable and the irrational?
So, first of all, in my perspective, I think that the bankers clearly have the wrong incentive structure, as Nassim indicated. But I don't think they were doing it in a cost-benefit analysis. I don't think it was a thoughtful, deliberate way to mislead people. I think they were truly viewing the world from the biased perspective of their own glasses. They created models, and once they created these models, they start believing them. And we see this happening in every engineering, in every part of scientific endeavor. People create models, they start believing in these models, they believe them too much, they start looking at the world only from those tinted glasses that actually have their self-benefit. So I think they're not evil people, they're just misguided. But the other point is, the question is, what kind of system are we building? And I think a good analogy is to think about roads. You know, I don't know about you, but when I drive, I make a mistake about every 15 minutes. You know, go a little bit too much to the right, too much to the left, change lane by mistake, and so on. I hope my wife is not listening. but the thing is that we understand that, and when we build roads, we build them flexible enough so that people can make mistakes and still survive. when we build the financial system, it has no latitude for mistakes. We leverage, we take incredible risk, and it's equivalent to making roads that have zero tolerance, that the moment you make a millimeter to the left, you bang into another car.
And, Nassim,
and that, I think, is what happens.
And Nassim, on the scale of the global economy, when there's no room for error, it takes the whole planet down. And that's what you've said in your book.
Exactly. My problem is that the system was built in a way not to tolerate any mistake. It didn't have redundancy. That's the problem with globalization. It brings everything to its maximum so-called efficiency. So nobody has any cash on the side. People take maximum risk. And also the nature of risk they take, willingly or, I mean, then Ariely thinks that they're not really doing it on purpose, that it just happened that way. But I think there's a combination of I think, misdemeanor and ignorance. But anyway, so they tend to take these risks that don't show on a daily basis, what I call hidden risk, classes of hidden risk. They take a lot of these risks. So they bet the ranch on no, and they tell you, look, my right. performance is not volatile. And sure enough, when you discover, when you make that mistake, it's always too late, so you don't have time to learn.
And we're the ranch. That's what we discover. The taxpayers are the ranch. Nassim Nicholas Taleb is the author of The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable, Distinguished Professor of Risk Engineering at NYU. And Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. He's a Duke professor of behavioral economics. Fascinating discussion this hour.
Oh, no question. My takeaway, the banks have taken over the government.
Yes.
Right?
And nationalize the losses. I love that. That's perfect.
We're always on at the takeaway, and Election Day is less than 5 weeks away. We got you covered. Check out vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
It's Palin versus Biden, the ticket tonight. You can join me and Andrea Bernstein at thetakeaway.org. We're going to be live blogging. You'll be able to join the conversation. Find a link on our homepage at thetakeaway.org.
So you think the House voted against the bailout plan because of revenge?
Yeah, this is George from White Plains. Your guest has got it wrong. Revenge just precipitates more revenge. Remember the McCoys and the Hatfields? But the threat of revenge, the threat's more powerful than the execution.
You can make threats to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
Please, please don't.
Go ahead.
Please don't, Adora Udoshi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org.
A one and only television event, Veep versus Veep. Okay, that won't happen. But in St. Louis tonight, almost anything else could. Will the most highly anticipated debate of the campaign between Governor Sarah Palin and Senator Joe Biden be a frank discussion of the issues or more material for Saturday Night Live? Sketch comedy meets sketchy politics on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 2nd, and it is a big day for Joe Biden and Sarah Palin.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, the financial plan to steady the U.S. markets is in the hands of the House of Representatives. Late last night, the Senate passed the revised measure with a bipartisan majority. Also, a view from the ground on the credit freeze. Car sales plummeted last month. And the vice presidential debate tonight, millions will be watching. We have a preview on a day where polls are showing the Obama ticket has an edge. Those stories are coming up, but first, here's a few headlines.
In the Senate last night, the vote was 74 to 25, and both presidential candidates voted for the bailout plan for the financial sector. In La Crosse, Wisconsin, before the vote, Barack Obama urged Congress to step up and pass the bill.
This is what we have to do right now to prevent a crisis from turning into a catastrophe. And that's why I've been reaching out to leaders in both parties to do whatever I can to help pass this plan. That's why I'll be flying back to Washington today to cast my vote to safeguard the American economy.
And so he did. John McCain told voters in Independence, Missouri, that he has strict financial plans if he's elected.
As president, I will impose a one-year spending freeze on every agency of the federal government. accepting only national defense, the care of our veterans, and a few critical priorities.
Few critical priorities. How much does that cost? The global markets responded with a kind of a shrug to the news of the Senate vote. Asian markets closed down, European markets flat. The Dow futures are down more than 135 points before the bell.
Overseas, the top American commander in Afghanistan, General David McKiernan, says things are likely to get worse there before they get any better.
The additional military capabilities that have been asked for are needed as quickly as possible.
Right now, about 33,000 U.S. troops are there. Violence in Afghanistan is up about 30% compared to last year.
We'll have more details in a moment, but a nuclear arms pact between India and the U.S. passed its final legislative hurdle yesterday. The Senate voted to let U.S. companies sell nuclear technology and fuel to India. In return, India agrees to let inspectors in. Baseball yesterday, Dodgers beat the Cubs 7-2. Phillies beat the Brewers 3-1. Red Sox beat the Angels 4-1. It's debate night.
Biden and Palin, they will be in St. Louis, while McCain's in Denver and Obama's in Michigan today. Oil's at a $98 a barrel in Asian trading. The Dow closed slightly down yesterday, and the S&P is set to open at 1161.
So we'll be live blogging the debate tonight, but tell us you'll be watching and what you'll be watching for. And if you had a question to ask, what would it be? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
A question for Joe Biden or Sarah Palin. What do you think each of them needs to do to be convincing? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Call it a bailout or call it a rescue plan. The Senate has spoken, and it's on its way to the House, where Democratic Congressman who joins us now, Maurice Hinchey, will get a chance to vote on it. He's from New York's 22nd Congressional District. He voted against the bill on Monday. Congressman, it's so nice to have you joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
First of all, why did you vote against on Monday, and what could possibly be in the Senate bill that would attract you to vote the other way on Friday?
Well, the amount of the authorization appropriation, $700 billion, is much too high. You're authorizing this to be dealt with by an administration who's going to be in office for a little more than 3.5 months. And that appropriation of $700 billion is going to effectively authorize the increase in the national debt to above $11 trillion, $11.3 trillion. We've already seen the national debt over the course of the last less than 8 years almost double as a result of the fiscal policies of this administration, the borrow and spend policies of this administration.
Congressman, I'm hearing a no vote.
In order to engage in spending.
I'm hearing a no vote from you.
You're hearing a no vote last week and earlier this week.
I mean, they're going to spend more on this bill. They've added spending. They haven't subtracted. So you've got to vote no on Friday then.
Well, some of the addition of spending that they put in the Senate bill is positive. And some of that additional spending will probably also have in positive impacts on the economy. But there are certain provisions in that bill that was passed in the Senate which are going to attempt to deal very, very modestly, unfortunately, with trying to improve the economy in a real way. Look what's been happening to this economy. Just over the course of the last 8 months, we've lost more than 600,000 jobs. In the month of August alone, we lost more than 84,000 jobs. More than 60,000 of those jobs were manufacturing jobs. That's the main problem that we have. We have a problem here of an administration that has refused to invest in the internal economy of our country while it wastes huge amount of money in other areas, particularly like Iraq, continuing to spend between $10 and $12 billion a month in Iraq in a very wasteful way.
Let me ask you this, Congressman. Where is that line between holding the administration accountable, holding the leaders of Wall Street accountable, but also restoring some sense of confidence in the marketplace, not only for American consumers, but also for the global markets?
Well, I think that line with regard to this bailout bill is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $150 billion. If we were to pass a piece of legislation or bring up a piece of legislation that would authorize the expenditure of less than half of $700 billion, $150 billion of which would be focused on this issue over the course of the next three and a half months, then I think that makes sense, particularly if you incorporate within that some internal spending that is going to deal with the failure of the basic infrastructure
Let's specifically take that apart. Did you vote for or against the housing bill last July, which was $330 billion?
The housing bill?
Yeah.
The housing bill is an internal investment in our country.
Congressman, I asked, did you vote yes or no?
I'm telling you that I voted yes, but
okay.
it's an important bill for
fine.
Internal investment. That's
how
what
come,
we need.
How come $330 billion is fine, but anything over $150 billion today when the markets and the crisis is much worse is suddenly way too much?
Well, the crisis isn't much worse. You heard the discussion about the market dropping to record numbers. All right, yes, it dropped by 777 points.
Actually, I'm not so concerned about the market. I'm concerned about bank failures and the fact that people like Roosevelt can't get credit and that businesses can't finance their payroll.
Okay. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
So how does...
Are you going to allow me to answer your question?
No, I want to know how this bill addresses that because it really, I don't see
that.
Okay,
go ahead. I'm trying to tell you that.
Go ahead.
In order to address the bill, you have to understand the problem. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I really want to know what's in the bill that's going to address
these
things.
If you need to understand the problem, then you need to understand the impact that it's had on the market. The impact that it's had on the market was a falling of about 7%. That falling now has gone up, so it's down about something in the neighborhood of 2 to 3%. If you go back to 1987 and look at the savings and loan crisis, you see how the market fell by 23%, more than three times what it fell earlier this week.
I understand
so
all
that.
So
you have to understand that this is not the most serious fall in the history of the country since the Great Depression,
what?
Which is what some people have been saying.
What is
you
in
have
the,
to understand the facts.
What is in the Senate bill that's going to address this infrastructure problem that you've talked about for the last 5 minutes?
Well, it was just what was mentioned a couple of minutes ago by you, I think, or by Adora.
So you don't know what it is?
It has to do with some internal investments in the country, but it doesn't deal with
Congressman, the Senate bill has tax credits in there, and it has an increase in the insurance for the FDIC. That's it. How does that invest in infrastructure?
Well, that's what it does, by providing some tax credits, and it also focuses some of those tax credits on alternative energy, which is a positive internal investment. And the increase in protection for savings is somewhat helpful. But the fact of the matter is that it still provides for $700 billion of expenditure, which jacks up the national debt, as I said, to $11.3 trillion.
In your estimation...
Which doesn't focus attention on the internal domestic needs of the country, which are causing the economic problems that we're facing.
So you're voting no?
Well, it depends on what our bill is going to look at. I don't think that the Senate bill improves the situation enough, frankly. I don't think it's addressed the situation adequately.
Sounds like a no vote. Thanks for joining us, Democratic Congressman Maurice Hinchey, New York's 22nd Congressional District. Adora?
And a story that's been a bit obscured by all of the developments in the markets here in the U.S., the Senate has approved a controversial civilian nuclear deal with India. Now, the deal allows legal exports of American nuclear materials to India after more than three decades. It's a landmark agreement, and it's seen as a cornerstone in the fast-improving relationship between the two countries. For more, we're joined by BBC correspondent Chris Morse, who is currently in Delhi. Chris, thanks for being with us. Do you want to describe this deal and what it means to India?
Yeah, what it does really is end India's long isolation from the international regime of nuclear technology. It's long been a sore point here in India that they've been kept right at the margins and not allowed to buy that technology, which they so desperately need to create infrastructure for power, for electricity and so forth. And it's clear that the U.S. now looks at India and sees India as a strategic ally in Asia. It looks at instability in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It looks the other way and sees the rise of China. And it likes what it sees when it looks at India as a federal democracy right at the heart of Asia. And I think officials in Washington knew that if they were going to really bring India into a much closer relationship, they had to deal with this long-standing nuclear issue. And that's what this deal does.
Now, the Pakistanis must have a reaction, of course, longtime rivals, and certainly lots of tension along that border there between those two countries.
Yeah, Pakistan has already said, well, we'd quite like a deal along the same lines, and I think it's something they're not going to get. As you know, there's been quite a lot of disquiet expressed around the world that there are nuclear weapons in Pakistan at a time of such instability there. And I think any sort of transfer of nuclear technology, even if it's for civilian peaceful use, would be something which simply isn't going to happen from a Western perspective. It's interesting, though, that Pakistan has been talking to China about increased nuclear technology cooperation as a direct result of the U.S.-India deal. So Pakistan will keep pushing with its friend in the West, but it's going to look at alternative sources as well.
So we're talking about civilian uses of nuclear power. What about issues revolving nuclear weapons?
Well, this is where the critics come in, both in the U.S. and in other countries around the world, who are concerned about what message this deal sends about global non-proliferation. Because obviously, if you transfer technology, which is for peaceful civilian use, parts of it can possibly, on the quiet, be redistributed into some kind of military program. Now, the Indians say, look, we don't need to do that, because we already have nuclear weapons of our own. But still a lot of people say, well, it's still sending a bad message. This is a country which hasn't signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which hasn't signed up to a lot of those international agreements, which would bring it on its own into the nuclear fold. And it stood firm, saying, no, we want to deal on the civilian sector. And there are plenty of people who will tell you, well, in a sense, the U.S. and the West has caved into that demand because they realize they need a good relationship with India.
Chris Morris, thanks for that update. We do appreciate it. Chris Morris, a BBC correspondent, he was reporting from Delhi on the U.S.-India nuclear agreement.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We've been getting reaction all morning from you on the Senate's vote last night to approve the financial plan, the $700 billion financial plan to help the U.S. economy. And many of you are a bit frustrated.
Hi, this is Gail from Everett, Washington. I believe this bailout is complete and total baloney, and I don't think either Obama or McCain get it. We don't need money to buy cars. What we need is money. They need to give the people the money, not Wall Street.
We want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Markets are reacting this morning to the word that jobless claims remained at a seven-year high this week, which relates directly to what's going on in the economy right now. When you hear the words credit freeze, businesses can't get loans. It means they have to shut down or curtail their operation. For a look at how this actually works with small businesses, we turn to Alex Vantarakis, who is the founder of the investment banking and debt funding company, the Vant Group. He's in Dallas, Texas. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Well, thank you.
And you are watching this pretty closely, and I'm wondering if you see particular signs of the credit freeze in your neck of the woods.
Unfortunately, I do. I deal in small businesses, and anybody trying to grow or stabilize in this economy is having a hard time because of the credit freeze. Small businesses aren't able to get funding to either grow their business or just sustain their operations, and it's taken a little bit of a toll on them.
Well, it's not even a little bit. The Federal Reserve says that the tightening of loan availability to small businesses surged to a record high of 65.3% in the third quarter, and that's up 7%, more than 7% from a year ago. What does that mean in terms of payrolls, hiring, inventories?
Well, what we're seeing is, you know, obviously Americans are going out less, they're buying less, and small business owners, you know, unfortunately have fixed overhead. And, you know, those that have planned correctly and have budgeted correctly are doing okay right now. But those that haven't, that usually rely on their lines of credit, are really suffering. And, you know, their only options right now are to kind of take a look back and figure out a way to start cutting expenses. And unfortunately, expenses are usually going to be either people or the worst that could happen, which is they just have to close down completely.
Alex, are there specific kinds of businesses that are really hurting? And of course, in bad times or suspect times, there's always someone flourishing. Are there some companies where this is actually a good time for business?
Well, the obvious ones that are hurting right now, at least down in Texas, are construction-related businesses and high-end type of disposable income type companies. The businesses that are flourishing are the ones that I think will flourish in any economy. Anything that's related to a necessity that people have to have, like services, you know,
healthcare.
Exactly, healthcare, attorneys, CPAs, you know, computer companies, for example, that take care of IT. Well, unfortunately, your computers are going to break, and we all need our computers to survive in this world. Hmm. So there are certain businesses that will always be at least staying above board, if not doing a little bit better.
You know, a lot of people have talked this week about, even if this bailout gets passed or this rescue gets passed and banks are relieved from having to report all these toxic assets, there's nothing in the economy or there's nothing that Washington can do that can actually compel banks and lending institutions to start lending again. Is it possible that there will still be resistance to lending just from the sheer shock of what's happened in the last past few months, even if money does start to flow a little bit more into the banks?
Well, obviously, I hope that's not the case. And I don't honestly believe that it is. Even in this economy right now, you know, our banks are in business to, you know, part of their decree is to lend money. And in the small business community, and what I define by small business community, are the banks that are making, you know, SBA-type loans between $100,000 and a million or so. Those deals are still getting done. They're a lot harder. The terms are a little bit higher. The requirements are higher. But they're still getting deals done. And I'm hoping once this bailout takes place that those people will not only continue to do deals, but to increase the amount of deals that they do. Because, you know, the SBA is a great program and it's self-funded. So there's really no reason why at least
right.
that portion of the funding community doesn't continue.
Right. You're referring to the SBA, the Small Business Administration program. Well, last question, Alex. What is a deal that you could have done a year ago, no problem, that you can't do today?
A $1 million loan on a business purchase that was made to a corporate executive that had little work experience, but a good credit score and about 10% down. Those were very common deals a year ago. And now you're going to have direct business experience. You're going to have an above average credit score, and you're going to need 20 to 30% down.
Interesting. Well, I mean, in some ways, you could say that might be a good thing because, you know, it might reduce the amount of speculation. But on the other hand, it does mean that certain sectors of the economy are shutting down. Alex Vantarakis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Alex Vantarakis is the founder of the investment banking and debt funding company called the Vant Group. He's in Dallas. And right here in the studio with us for Femi OK is Richard Hake with
and
headlines.
John, government data shows that applications for unemployment benefits are at a 7-year high. The Department of Labor reports the impacts of hurricanes Ike and Gustav and the weakening economy are to blame. UN officials say that the organization is raising its security level for the Pakistani capital. This comes after last month's truck bombing of the Islamabad Marriott Hotel. The order means international staff will no longer be allowed to live with their children in the capital. Also, officials are hoping to confirm whether wreckage now spotted in a rugged part of eastern California is from the plane flown by missing adventurer Steve Fawcett. A hiker found what appears to be some of Fawcett's belongings in the area earlier this week. He's been missing for almost a year now. And both political parties are trying to build up expectations for the rival vice presidential candidate ahead of tonight's Palin-Biden debate. And others are also getting into the act. So how do you get young people to the polls? You take some celebrities like Leonardo DiCaprio, you make a video, you put it up on YouTube, and then tell them not to do something.
Please, just don't vote.
Don't vote.
Don't vote.
Don't vote.
No, seriously, don't.
You don't care.
What's the point? Don't.
Don't vote.
Don't vote, really.
Some nice, tidy reverse psychology.
Reverse psychology. Yeah. And, of course, midway through the spot, they, you know, turn around, say it's your civic duty to vote. And this is expected to go throughout the internet, and everyone's supposed to get a copy of this.
Well, why doesn't Leo do that with his movies? Don't go to my movies. Don't go to my movies.
It'll be a great trailer. Just fine.
I don't think he does anything anyway. Does one or two interviews, and you know, that's it.
Reverse psychology.
Yeah.
Celebrity reverse psychology here on The Takeaway. Richard Haig, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased...
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It's Biden versus Palin tonight, and we want to look at the debate record of both of these individuals. We wanted to find people who really are familiar with them. We're going to talk about Sarah Palin in a moment. But first, Joe Biden. I mean, Rita Farrell is a former Reuters correspondent who's been covering Senator Biden since he was first elected to the Senate in 1972. She is the best. Rita, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So you've seen Joe Biden in lots of debates, lots of campaigns, and I have to say, just from my perspective, I've been watching him since the mid-'80s, debate doesn't necessarily, you know, show him in his best light. What's your view?
Well, tonight's debate is going to be an unusual one because it's one-on-one. He's usually debating when he was a presidential candidate, for example, and he had other people on the stage, and he didn't have control of the situation. When he most of his talking is retail politics, when he can get into a crowd and soften the edges of some of his tougher statements. So he's very, very good at, of course, everybody knows that he knows what he's talking about as far as policy and that sort of thing. But tonight will be a very different thing. He has to be able to say less. She has to be able to know more. So I think that probably sets the stage.
Well, here's an indication with Anderson Cooper on CNN back in July about saying less might not be a significant challenge for Joe Biden. Take a listen to this, Rita.
I think he just made an admission against self-interest. I don't know that he's mentally qualified to own that gun. No, I'm being serious. Look, this idea we go around talking about people who owned, I'm the guy that originally wrote the assault weapons ban that became law, and then we got defeated, then Dianne Feinstein went to town on it and did a great job. Look, we should be working with law enforcement right now to make sure that we protect people against people who are not capable of knowing what to do with a gun because they're either mentally imbalanced and or because they have a criminal record.
Time.
And anyway.
That's Anderson Cooper saying, time.
Well, that was in response to somebody in the audience at one time who talked about his right to pack and wanted to be packing. And yes, he actually, there was one of these gridiron dinners in Delaware where he was portrayed as the Energizer Bunny, just keeps talking and talking and talking. But he gets so very passionate about what he's saying, and he knows a lot about this. He's had a lot of bills about protecting police and so he knows about it. He has this an urge to be able to talk about what he knows about and wants to inform you whether you want to be informed or not.
Well, the passion could be good. The question of whether he's correct or not has come up already in this campaign. That will be a challenge for him. Rita Farrell, we're going to take a look at the Sarah Palin side of the question here, but thanks so much for joining us. I know you'll be watching tonight.
You're welcome.
Rita Farrell, former Reuters correspondent, has been covering Joe Biden since 1972. Adora?
I think I'm going to borrow a line from Rita there where she says Biden needs to say less and Palin needs to say more.
That's needs to know more.
Needs to say more. Or know more. I mean, that seems to be the conventional wisdom. And on the line with us right now is longtime Alaska journalist Larry Persily, who not only has covered Governor Palin, but also worked for her. Welcome, Larry.
Good morning.
Describe her debating style.
Well, I guess it is short, not long answers, though certainly we've seen her give two long answers to Kay Kirk and others, where she's been groping for information, but it's short. She's gushing, she's enthusiastic, she's emotional, she talks about Alaska being blessed and the country being blessed. She goes for the emotional buttons, not the policy buttons on people.
So you would describe her as having a lot of personality in her presentation?
If she is doing the right thing tonight, from her perspective, she will talk in personality. She will project her personality. She will sell her personality. She will not try to out-policy Joe Biden.
Let's listen to an exchange with Toni Knowles when she was running for governor.
Toni, there you go again. We discussed this yesterday. I kind of set you straight yesterday. We'll do it again today. Toni, I haven't had a private jet to be able to bum from one of my lobbyist friends to zip all over the state and meet and reach every single constituency group that you have.
That sounds like a feisty, direct, confident politician.
Well, I'm not sure about the word competent, but yes, she is feisty, and she knows how to put down her opponents. In a debate I was a panelist on in November of 06, when asked if she were governor, would she hire Toni Knowles for her administration? She basically said, yeah, I'd hire him as a cook at the mansion because you used to cook at a restaurant, and that's probably what you should be doing. So she knows the put down, but she does it with such a smile.
She hasn't really come across in that manner in the national attention that and the national interviews that she's so far done. We haven't seen her in a national debate, but let's listen to how she responds to Katie Couric's question about the bailout financial plan on Capitol Hill.
If it doesn't pass, what is the alternative?
As I say, inaction is not an option. We have got to shore up our economy. This is a crisis moment for America, really the rest of the world also, looking to see what the impacts will be if America were to choose not to shore up what has happened on Wall Street because of the ultimate adverse effects on Main Street and then how that affects this globalization that we're a part of in our world. So.
Larry, I found that really difficult to understand exactly what she's saying.
I think she's saying, I read somewhere it's a crisis and it's a problem on Wall Street, but people who vote for me live on Main Street, so I better talk about them too.
That's good. Maybe we should have you like closed captioning the debate tonight.
I could do real-time translation like they do in the UN with the headsets.
So, I mean, you actually worked for her. How was she different? How was your perception changed in working with her as opposed to what you thought of her when you were covering her as a politician?
Really no difference. When I was opinion page editor at the Anchorage paper in 2006, we did not endorse her for governor. We said she was not up for the job. She didn't have anything close to the depth of understanding. And that's what I saw as a state worker in her office, too. She has a very engaging personality, a very warm and enthusiastic, very friendly person. But you try to drill down and get into some issues, it's just not there. She manages by BlackBerry and really has little interest in sitting down for long briefings. She feels her personality, the sound bites, the smile can carry the day. And so far it's done that in Alaska for her.
Larry Persily, thank you. Larry is a longtime Alaska journalist and a former employee in Sarah Palin's Washington office. And will you be watching Sarah Palin and Joe Biden tonight?
Hi, my name is Michael from Brooklyn, and I'll be watching tonight's debate.
to find out how many times Sarah Palin says, that's a very good question. Thanks.
Our nasty listeners, yes, if you want to weigh in on the debate, 877-8-MY-TAKE is the way to do it. But more importantly, if you're one of the 50 or 60 million people who are going to be watching the debate, we're going to be live blogging it. You can reach us at 2008.thetakeaway.org or just go to our page. You'll find a live blogging link right there on the front.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. We're going to take the next few minutes to talk about the standoff that's taking place in the Indian Ocean between Somali pirates and a Ukrainian ship laden with tanks and heavy weapons. There are U.S. warships in those waters. A British think tank today releases a report that shows just how serious the problem of piracy has become. And the report was issued by Chatham House. Piracy off the coast of Somalia has more than doubled in 2008. Roger Middleton, a researcher for the Africa Program at the Chatham House think tank, joins us from London. Roger, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
First of all, you know, we always know that pirates have exploited geographic advantages in open waters, and the fact that these pirates are in Somalian waters is an indication that they have a kind of a geographic advantage over ships passing by. But in this particular case, there are technological reasons that make piracy even easier than it was, you know, 200 or 300 years ago. What are those?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of reasons why Somalia is such a great place for pirates to base themselves. As you say, the geographical location on the edge of some of the most important trade routes in the world. Also, the complete lack of central government control in Somalia means there's very little law enforcement. So these pirates have a relatively free hand. But then, as you were alluding to in your question, this question of technological ability, Somalia is one of the countries in Africa which has the easiest access to small arms, to rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and to other equipment which you need to be a well-armed pirate. And these pirates are very well-armed.
But really, it's not that hard. I mean, a small boat with a good engine, some GPS equipment, some RPGs, and you can set up your own piracy.
Well, yes, and this is what's happening. The boats the pirates are using, they're all made from the same mold, and the same boats that are used by Somali fishermen and small traders are widely available in Somalia. It's very easy to get yourself an AK-47 and a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, GPS, satellite phones. These kind of things are giving them an extra edge, making it increasing their range. In the past, you know, the dangerous area was a sort of 50 miles off the Somali coast, and now that extends to 200-400 miles off the Somali coast.
That's interesting. Any indication of the cost to world shipping from all this from the Chatham House report?
Yeah, well, I estimate in that report that the cost in terms of ransom payments is somewhere around $30 million so far this year.
And so they're really doing well.
And the pirates, yes, they're doing very well. They're making a lot of money. And these are people from incredibly poor backgrounds. Their traditional livelihood of fishing or of pastoral farming with goats and camels, those have been badly affected by the drought and by the instability in Somalia. So to be able to make a proportion of $1 million or $2 million or perhaps $20 million if the current standoff is paid off to their demand, then that's a huge opportunity for them.
So $30 million in ransom. Quickly before we go, what in terms of costs by shippers who have to avoid them and maybe have escorts?
Well, ships that are going through there are having to pay increased insurance costs. That's called a war risk premium, and that's gone up 10 times so far this year. So it's really adding to the cost of shipping. And the real danger there is that shipping finds this too expensive and too dangerous and diverts around South Africa, adding weeks to the journey from Asia and from the Middle East to Europe and North America.
And we've already lost
a serious inflationary pressure on prices.
And we've already lost shipping of food supplies into the Horn of Africa, relief supplies, as a result of the piracy. Roger Middleton is a researcher for the Africa Program at the foreign affairs think tank Chatham House.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Huckenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 2nd. Richard Hake is here with the headlines. He's sitting in for Femi Oke. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Adora. 12 minutes before the top of the hour. U.S. markets are down at the open today.
Is that your plummeting? Yeah, that's all right. I thought I'd help you out.
There you go. Sound effects. Yeah, sound effects. Got like a Prairie Home Companion, right? Government data shows that joblessness is at a 7-year high. The Department of Labor reports the impacts of Hurricane Ike and Gustav and the weakening economy are to blame. Now, apparently, the amount of money sent home by Mexicans living in the United States is dropping. Mexico's central bank says it's seen its biggest monthly drop since 1995. Remittances are Mexico's second largest source of foreign income. A U.S. soldier has pleaded guilty to charges of accessory to murder and the killings of 4 Iraqi prisoners. U.S. Army Specialist Stephen Robordi was sentenced to 8 months in prison and must testify in the prosecution against others alleged to have taken part in those killings. And a commuter train engineer sent a cell phone text message 22 seconds before his train crashed into that freight train near Los Angeles. 25 people died, and the NTSB spokesperson says they're not saying who did the texting.
There was a lot of interest in the text messaging, you know, but there's a lot of interest in this accident, period. And our main concern is to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again.
Apparently now they're going to put into effect a rule that you cannot use a cell phone or any other electronic device while operating a train.
It's a big story. We don't allow BlackBerries in here either. Thank you, Richard. Richard Hake. Richard, he shoots. He scores. Ouch, man.
Is that a new rule?
Wow. Yeah, it's a new rule. Senate voted yes, but we're hearing lots of frustration from you about the bailout.
Hi, it's Ann from Shrewsbury. On this rushing through of this legislation, no good has ever come of acting under duress. We have to hit absolute bottom to learn the lesson from this situation, which hopefully will be personal responsibility and personal savings.
The Economic 12-Step Program on the Takeaway. Of course, tonight it's Palin versus Biden. Will you be watching? And what's on your mind regarding the debate? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Dora?
And new polls are out that show Barack Obama, his campaign, is picking up some points just as those debates, the debate between Palin and Biden, gets underway tonight. For more on that poll and others, we turn now to Adam Nagorny of the New York Times. Good morning, Adam. You want to give us some highlights of the latest polls?
Yeah, there's a couple of polls that come out. One was a national poll by CBS, and then a couple of battleground state polls by Time, CNN, and Quinnipiac. First of all, they're mostly showing that Senator Obama has a statistically significant lead nationally and also in a bunch of states. That's the first thing. And I think that polls now these kind of horse race polls tend to become significant. I mean, during the year, I don't think that they mean that much, but people are beginning to make decisions now, and people are beginning to vote now. They also have come, as you noted, just after this week when we've had this fiscal crisis and the first debate of the two presidential candidates. So people are, I think, making informed decisions. The CBS News poll in particular suggested that Senator Obama is benefiting, as it were, from the fiscal crisis. More people seem to think that he has a plan to deal with it than Senator McCain does. And more people, not a majority, but more, say they approve of the way that Senator Obama has responded to this versus the way Senator McCain has responded to this. Also, something like two-thirds said they didn't think it made any difference at all when Senator McCain suspended his campaign and went back to Washington last week to try to save the fiscal plan.
And perhaps more interesting, as you referred to, is the polls in critical states like Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, something that each of the campaigns is going to be looking at very, very closely.
That's right. Most people talk about national polls, but again, we don't elect presidents nationally. We elect them by the Electoral College. So the really interesting thing to take a look at, are these battleground state polls. And you got to be a little careful with some of these because some of them aren't necessarily good because it's hard to do. But you begin to see a pattern. And, you know, we are seeing that nothing is set in stone here, but we are seeing signs that he is making progress in states. Senator Obama is making progress in states like Pennsylvania, where he thought that a lot of people thought he'd be in trouble. Iowa, which President Bush won narrowly last time. Florida is more in play than I thought it was going to be. I mean, don't forget, President Bush won it by 5 points last time, and I thought it was going to be a tough state for Obama, but we see a number of polls that show it either tied or that he's moving ahead. Similarly, North Carolina, that's a state where Senator McCain should probably be doing pretty easily. The polls show it tied or Senator Obama slightly ahead. So just generally, the general feeling is that things at this moment, and I stress at this moment, are moving in Senator Obama's direction. And it's happening again at a critical time in the election cycle.
Well, Sarah Silverman is probably taking credit for the improvement down in Florida. But Adam, nothing is set in stone because you're describing trends that indicate movement. Is there any way of separating something that your paper has reported significantly, that is that among Republican activists, there seems to be a lot of concern about Sarah Palin and whether she's an asset or maybe a liability, and whether the economic downturn or this panic or whatever you want to call it with the markets is having an impact on turning people from undecided to Obama. Any way to separate those out?
You can't say it discreetly, but you can look at the poll. You can find evidence that all that's true. For example, the last poll we did found that Sarah Palin was helping Senator McCain with the base, but we found no evidence that it was going beyond the base. In this poll, we found there was an increase in the number of people who said they had an unfavorable opinion of Governor Palin, or that she was not ready to be president. So you can look at that and think, well, people are looking at that and thinking, okay, do we want her to be vice president or not? So that's part of it. And again, I think the economy in this latest CBS poll, we've never had the figure. CBS and the New York Times had the poll together. We've never had the figure regarding economic anxiety to be this high ever.
Wow.
And the approval rating for President Bush is as low as ever. And finally, it's crazy that it sounds like it's just the New Yorker. I actually think Sarah Silverman could matter a little bit, because I think those voters, people's grandparents from New York.
You're talking about the comedian, just so we're clear.
No,
we're talking about the comedian.
Talking about kids encouraging their Jewish grandparents to vote for Obama.
And she did a video.
Schlepp,
she had a video that I guess went viral, where she encourages kids of Jewish grandparents who have retired in Miami to go down and tell their grandparents to vote for Obama.
That's interesting. But I think you make an interesting point here, Adam, which is we ought to be a little weary of all of the polls, especially given this has been a unusual election year. But more importantly, that you have this number of people who seem to go in and out of this undecided pool. And so with this many weeks left until the official voting day, a lot can happen.
That's right. And the other caveat I'd say is, people keep forgetting this. Obviously, if Senator Obama was elected, he would be the first African-American president. We do not know whether or not polling is undercounting the number of people who would vote against him for that reason. And there is reason to think that there are some people who will vote against him for that reason and not tell pollsters that.
Oh, certainly. Our takeaway political director has found that in some of the swing states, that voters simply will not vote for him because he's black.
That's absolutely true. I heard that. That's absolutely true. And then the question is, will those voters tell the pollsters that? We don't know. But the other side of that is a big part of the Obama campaign is getting a lot of new voters into the system, whether they're young voters or African-American voters. So to what extent will that sort of counter stuff? So generally, I've become more and more wary of polls over the years, particularly as more people have been using cell phones and we've had some problems with polling. I think this year polling is really tough, but you can step back and look, and you can say there does appear to be a trend. And I think there's a trend going on right now. Whether that means in the end that Senator Obama is going to actually win, who knows? But I do think right now there are decisions being made.
Trends are very important. And listen, very, very, very quickly, your 2 cents on the debate tonight between Palin and Biden and how important you think it is.
You know what? I hate to go. I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting. It's important if she either really makes the kind of mistakes that she made on Katie Couric and sort of reinforces the idea that she's not ready to be president, or if she gets in there and just hits it out of the park and makes everyone go, we see what Senator McCain chose her, she'd be a great president. But absent those two alternatives, which I think are actually the least likely two alternatives, she just does fine. Like, she does the way she's done in debates in Alaska. She makes her points. She puts down, she makes the case against Senator Obama.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't make any mistakes. I think it won't really change things much, frankly.
Adam Nagorny, great pleasure as always.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adam Nagorny, New York Times reporter and our friend here at The Takeaway.
Whose beat is The Great Schlepp from Sarah Silverman. Here's a clip.
If you knew that visiting your grandparents could change the world, would you do it? Of course you would.
course you
there
would.
You go. We're always on at the Takeaway, and Election Day is less than 5 weeks away. Check out vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
We're going to be live blogging tonight, and we're definitely hearing some frustration about the bailout plan from listeners like Louise.
If this bailout is, rescue plan, is so imperfect, as so many senators had mentioned yesterday, then why don't we have a better plan?
Why? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's your takeaway.
She goes for the emotional buttons, not the policy buttons on people.
That's Larry Persila, a longtime Alaska journalist, talking about Sarah Palin. He also used to work for her.
We're going to be live blogging the vice presidential debate. Watch it tonight at 8. Join me and Andrea Bernstein. I'm John Hockenberry, and you are?
I'm Adora Udoji,
and this is The Takeaway!
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org.